job, it's just you. Everything's on you. It's who you are. Ella's voice made this sobbing sound on the last word. She turned her head and stared at the painting on the wall. A reproduction Degas, pair of ballet dancers in wide blue tutus like the opening of flowers.
Fine, then. Wallow in misery. My God, you young people, you take everything so damned seriously. Life's a gas, Ella. Just stop and breathe it in once in a while. Believe me, it's gone before you know it.
Again, not helpful. Aunt Julie waved at her.
Oh, enough of this. You're boring me. Sit down, will you? I had something else to talk to you about, something important to discuss.
There was a gimlet emphasis on the important. What? Ella asked, still standing, eyeing the ballet dancer on the left, whose legs alone were visible and seemed to be caught in the middle of a fall.
I don't know. Something. Something. Damn it. Oh, that's right. About this apartment you're renting.
The change of subject was so abrupt, Ella actually turned from the picture and sat down, reached automatically for the brandy, which was topped with more whipped cream and constituted a dessert in itself. It's just for now, she said, until I can find something more permanent. Once the divorce is settled, probably. Saying the word divorce was easier than she'd thought. Maybe it was because the breakup seemed like the least of her troubles now. Or maybe it was because of the lawyer whom she'd called right after returning from coffee with Patrick before she could lose her nerve, who was so factual and unsympathetic, whose lack of sympathy actually made her feel better. She was just another wronged wife, just one among millions. The same old story. Better luck next time. Don't get mad. Get...
Your mama said it's on Christopher Street, number 11.
Ella blinked herself back to the present. Yes, number 11. I'm on the fourth floor. It's all right, kind of small.
I know it well. Well, the building, not the apartment itself.
Really? How?
I used to go dancing there back in the 20s, when the basement next door was a speakeasy.
Ella choked, coughed, grabbed her napkin. I'm sorry, did you say speakeasy?
Yes. Oh, it was terrific. Absolutely the best jazz. I used to go there every week, well, at least until it went under.
Went under?
Yes,
Aunt Julie said. She set down her glass and dabbed her lips, which had lost most of their magenta to the tuna salad and had faded to the color of Pepto-Bismol, leaking gently into the wrinkles around her mouth.
Something terrible happened there, and the place shut down and never opened again. I believe I heard that both buildings were bought up later for cheap and the bar was bricked in. All very hushed up and mysterious. And naturally, I've forgotten the details. But I always did wonder what became of Ginger.
Ginger? Aunt Julie's pocketbook lay next to her brandy glass. She lifted it and unhooked the clasp.
A friend of mine who lived at number 11.
She said, rummaging inside the pocketbook until she produced a postcard bearing a photograph of a naked woman lying on a Victorian chaise longue, face turned up and away toward an abstract portrait of another nude. The picture was black and white, except for the woman's hair, which had been tinted a brilliant auburn.
I dug this up when your mama told me. God knows why I kept it. A real dish, wasn't she? I've never seen another pair of knockers to equal those.
Act 5. We lift up our eyes to the Lord. Hallelujah, hallelujah. River Junction, Maryland, 1924. 1. About 10 minutes after we crossed the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, I realize I've left behind my mama's letters on the wicker table of Mrs. Marshall's pool house in Southampton, New York. Luella notices my distress. Luella Kingston, that's our Millicent Meriwether McDuff's real name, don't you know? At least she says it is. Frankly, I prefer McDuff. Something wrong? She asks, casting me a sideways glance, as she points the automobile down the darkened Lincoln Highway at a steady 51 miles per hour. Nothing. Nothing. Just something I left behind, that's all. Your virtue, maybe? I open my mouth to snap back that it's not my virtue lying among the tangled sheets a couple 100 miles behind us, by God. But I stop myself just in time. Whatever you say, McDuff. She reaches for her pocketbook with one hand. If I've seen one woman throw herself at that bastard, I've seen 100. And he chooses you. I wonder why you care. You don't happen to count yourself among the unlucky 100, do you? God, no. She fumbles with a pack of cigarettes, steadying the wheel with her knee. She's wearing a pair of men's trousers and checked brown wool and a Norfolk jacket, like she's off to the countryside to shoot pheasants or something. Her pale hair's caught up under a wool cap. Not glamorous, but tremendously capable. The kind of woman who can drive a 6-stroke automobile with one knee while extracting a thick masculine cigarette from a cardboard box. I'm just puzzled, that's all. Like they say, there's no accounting for taste, is there? Do you want a hand with that, before you wreck us inside a tree somewhere? Nah, I got it. She holds matchbook and wheel in the left hand, strikes the match with the right, lights the stick, which is stuck between her faded pink lips. So, how was it? How was what? You know, shacking up with Mr. Marshall. The word Marshall jars me. I turn my head to the window, though I can't see much. Just the shadows of trees, flipping past in a dark blur. The reek of burning tobacco fills the air. That bad, was it? Luella says. Or that good? Just watch the road, will you? My God, you're dead gone, aren't you? You are just plain cuckoo for that block of damned wood. I'd laugh if it weren't such a tragedy. He's not dead yet, for God's sake. She sucks hard on her cigarette and hauls down the window a few inches. A gust of wet air pours through the crack. I guess we'll find out soon, won't we? Try to get a little sleep, Carrots. You're going to need it. I wad up my jacket and stick it between head and window. Call me Carrots again, McDuff, and you'll be picking your teeth from the steering wheel. 2. The automobile is a Franklin 2-seater, racing green, 6 muscular cylinders. Belongs not to Luella, I hasten to add, but to Mr. Marshall himself, Lord and Master, who wasn't exactly around to sanction its requisition by the New York City Prohibition Enforcement Agency, though Mrs. Marshall assured me he won't mind. We didn't tell her the whole truth, of course. How could you tell a woman who's already lost one son that her remaining 2 boys are now the property of one Duke Kelly, hillbilly bootlegger? I couldn't do it, not least because the fault lies with me. Even the sanguine Luella is rattled, though she hides it all behind a bravado of wool trousers and cigarettes. She can't fool me. I can see the tremor in her fingers holding the smoke, the small nervous pulse of her lacquered thumb against the steering wheel. I have 1,000 questions I need to ask her, but it seems they're all stuck in my throat. Maybe I don't desire to know the answers. The miles pass, the towns pass, bleeding into the northern reaches of Philadelphia, the western suburbs, Bryn Mawr, against which side I shut my eyes. Wayne. Well, the good Lord hates a coward, Jen. I unstick my forehead from the window and say, how in the name of God did they take Billy? That's what I want to know. Last I saw him was a parlor in Glen Cove, Long Island. Didn't I tell you to get some sleep? Not the way you're driving. She tips her cigarette out the window. Just what was he doing in a parlor in Glen Cove? Proposing to me. I can't resist. Luella whistles. How you get around? Engaged to one brother and going to bed with the other all in the same night. I guess you can take the girl out of the hills. I told him no. Not that my private affairs are any of your beeswax. That's how I ended up back in the city. Where Anson found me. Anson? You mean Marshall? Not to me, he's not. No, she says thoughtfully, hunting for another cigarette. I guess he's not at that. Anyway, young Billy seems to have gone back into town in search of you, because that's where they snatched him. In that boarding house of yours. A big to-do. Christopher telephoned me with the news. Did they hurt him? She pauses. I expect he put up a struggle. Poor fool, they always do. So you went to find Anson. He wasn't home. Home? Where's home? He's got a little place near the river, away from his family. They've got a position, you know, a life on the society page. I know who they are. Anyway, it's a shabby little apartment on the west side, not much to speak of. One of those beds that folds out from the wall. She speaks with conscious familiarity, flicking a bit of ash out the window. He wasn't there. No sign of him. But when I went back to my own place, the landlady had a telephone message from him, where to find him if something came up. So I telephoned back first thing in the morning and made Mrs. Marshall fetch him for me, poor dear. And what time was that? I don't know. 6 or 7 o'clock, I guess. 6 or 7 o'clock. When I was falling back asleep, no doubt. Bone weary after our second bout at dawn. Side by side, faces and bodies illuminated by the sunrise. Hands soft in idolatry. My leg thrown over his hip. His eyes, now thoroughly sober, in which my reflection lay clear and torrid. How strange and how electrifying, to look into someone's eyes and see yourself. I don't recollect the pulling apart afterward, nor falling into slumber. But somehow Anson heard his mother's knock on the door and found the strength to rise. I clutch my fist under the shelter of my overcoat. Say, how did he get word to you in the first place anyway? I was right there with him the whole night, except when the doctor was stitching him up. Mrs. Marshall, of course. She rang me up about 10:30 last night. I consider the urgent conversation between mother and son while I was in the kitchen getting the water hot. I see. You've done this before, then. We've got a history, if that's what you mean. I was the one who stood by him when the Bureau kicked him out, trying to win back his good name. We started as partners, you know, spent all day together, sometimes all night. We got so close we could tell what the other was thinking, without saying a word. We would lay down our lives for each other. I see. No wonder you warned me off like that. Don't be jealous. Don't need to be. Whatever you like, doll. Any beans. I told him the news, and he went straight out in that motorboat. They caught him in New York Harbor. They? Your stepfather's men. They sent us word. I jumped on the next train out to Southampton to fetch you. Because, of course, poor Billy's just the bait, isn't he? Both of them. Billy and Anson. I'm the one he really wants. Exactly. Don't feel bad, honey. It's only business. It's not business to him. I'm not business. It is personal between Duke and me. About as personal as it could be. Oh, don't flatter yourself. He wouldn't go to this much trouble for a little family affair. You don't understand. Don't I? What kind of bunny do you think I am? What do you think I've been doing these past 3 years while you've been dancing and drinking and posing for photographs? I've been flirting with these fellows, fighting them, sleeping with them when I had to. I know them inside and out. And no boss risks good men for the sake of a private argument. No, ma'am, no matter how much he hates a girl, no matter how sore he is. Duke Kelly wants you for the same reason Marshall wanted you. Because you're the only person alive who can take him down. That's not true. Passelman know enough about Duke's business to put him in jail. But not one of them cares to turn against him, Dull. Only you. We are nearing some kind of town. A pair of yellow headlights grows and grows, bursting on our windshield like a double sun. And Luella slows the car. Worries the top of her cigarette with her thumb where it clutches the wheel, causing a small crumb of ash to fall from the end. A signpost flashes by, almost too fast to read. Some town named Coatesville. A few meager buildings rise up along the side of the road. Though the interior of the Franklin is chilly, a raw draft streaming in through the crack of Luella's window, still she perspires from her temples and probably her armpits. I can see the gleam on her skin in the light from the other car as it roars past. I can smell her feral scent, overlaid by traces of a familiar expensive perfume I can't quite recollect the name of. Something she must have put on before she left New York City to fetch me. Something left over from the night before. I'll wait until we pass through the town. Rows of worn, paint-chipped storefronts, waiting for a boom, before I speak again. So, the idea is, you give me up to Duke and get your man back. That's about the sum of it, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, Marshall's going to have other ideas. Oh? Luella shifts gears smoothly, sending the Franklin to a high, even speed, flying westward along the Lincoln Highway. The cigarette's gone, lost out the window, and she doesn't light another. The bastard never could resist trying to be a hero. 3. I guess I do fall asleep, because at some point, leaning back against the window, jacket crammed between ear and glass, I leave off thinking and commence to dream I'm back in bed with Anson. Except in this dream, he looms above me, gargantuan, uninjured, hips rocking against mine. And though we can't see each other, I am absolutely overpowered by the brawn in his limbs, by his mass, near enough suffocated, while a most powerful climax builds up a head of steam in my parts like an express locomotive. Faster and faster we go, thrusting like a piston, nearly there. Too much to bear. I lift up my hands to what I suppose is Anson's face, because I am plain afeard of the strength of this mountain explosion, scared to death. Need something dear to hold on to, but what I find is wet. Hot and soaking wet. His head is split open, and the blood pours over me. My neck and breasts and belly. While his body moves furiously on mine like a snake, still moves after it be cut in twain. And I open my mouth to scream, and I can't say nothing, can't see nothing. My throat is frozen, and my eyes are blind. And I startle so hard, I bang my head on the roof of the car. "Jesus," says Luella, swerving a little. "What's eating you?" "Nothing." I open my hands and stare at the bare palms. Dawn's starting to break. Just enough light that I can see there's no blood soaking me, only pale, cold skin. The shameful veins still throb between my legs, kind of painful, seeking the promised release. Feel as if I'm going to vomit. "Some nothing," she says. "Let me know when you see a service station. Almost out of gas." 4. We drive all morning and into the afternoon, under a sky made of cold Pennsylvania steel. I ask Luella why we couldn't take the train. We'd have arrived by now, aboard the good old B&O. "There's no hurry," she says. "The party doesn't start until you arrive, does it? Anyway, surprise is the only chance we've got. Only card in our hand." "You've got a plan, I hope." "Sure, I got a plan. The plan is, you do just as I say." "Yeah? I don't like your plan. This is my country. I know how to deal with these fellows. I know who I can trust and who I can't. I know who my stepdaddy is, how he thinks and where to find him." "Oh, shut your gums. You know nothing. Worse than nothing, because you think you're so damn clever, so damn irresistible. You can't just waltz into a gang of bootleggers like you waltz into a juice joint carrots. All your sex appeal doesn't count for beans when men are bent on business. I grab the wheel, elbow her in the side, and steer us into the grass by the side of the road. Car bumps and rolls and stops, while Luella tears at my skin. I wait until the tires stop rolling and the engine cuts before I let go the wheel, settle back in my seat, and say quietly, "What did I tell you about calling me carrots, McDuff?" "You've got some kind of complex, sister. You want to get us killed?" "I said don't do it, so don't." I wrap my hand around the bit of her hair falling below the cap and bring her ear next to my mouth. "I'll do what you tell me. I allow you've got more experience than me. But as soon as there's trouble, as soon as your nice plan falls apart, it's my rules, all right? My country, my rules. My life at stake. And Marshall's." She yanks her hair away. "That's what I meant." She starts the engine back up and sends the car back to the pavement, swearing as she goes. But she doesn't say another word. Not when we stop for gas and sandwiches in Gettysburg. Not when we turn off the Lincoln Highway and head south into Maryland. The clouds dim and turn to rain. At some point past sunset, she pulls off the road and switches off the engine again. Tells me it's time to get a few hours sleep before we roll into River Junction at dawn. 5. So long as I inhabited the town of my rearing, I can't ever recollect driving there in an automobile. There is but one road, finding passage betwixt a pair of low-sloped mountains, mostly following the line of the creek bed. In summer, said creek runs scarce more than a trickle, cold and mountain-fed, wandering past the grazing kine in the fields of billowing rye, gathering tranquility in the fishing hole where I once liked to murder my stepdaddy for his crimes against me. Now, though the world is still dark and sightless, I hear the voice of that creek as a raging god, swollen high by melting snow and late downpours. How it roars over the rocks. A fall of new rain smacks the windshield so hard, the automatic wipers can scarce keep up. And still the water bellows downstream, so loud and fearsome as I have ever heard it. I turn to Luella. "Creek's high." "What's that?" "Creek's high. Might could flood." "Over the road?" "No, not here. Other side of town, maybe, where it crosses the bridge." She makes a single nod, grips the wheel with her two long-fingered hands, no more steering by insouciant knee, no more lighting of cigarettes, and peers hard through the windshield, past the frantic swish-swish of the wiper blades to follow the streaming patch of road illuminated by the headlights. Around us, the mountains press close, coal black and unseen. The sky bears no trace of the coming sun. Just rain and more rain. The Lord Jesus weeping down pity for our sins, like my mama used to explain when I was but small. 6. But the rain does lift when the road bends into the holler, and the first houses creep past like solitary ghosts, recedes to a mere drizzle, as a brash spring downpour is wont to do. Luella switches off the headlights and I guide her off the road toward what used to be an old barn, but is now something else. A still, I dare swan, by the smell of rye mash and smoke. We make for the orchard instead, leave the Franklin there between the dripping trees, poised to run. Unlike Luella, I possess no hat and no mackintosh, just the overcoat bequeathed me by the Coast Guard captain. I turn up the collar and huddle inside as we trudge through the dark in the direction of Duke's splendid new mansion. Drizzle splintering through my hair. Tip of my nose numb with cold. Belly wet with fear. Some kind of fragile childhood map guiding my steps, together with the noise of the rushing creek. Now, according to Luella, The message from Duke came to her through our mutual friend Christopher, whose role in these affairs seems like that of Switzerland, so far as I can tell, and said message was about as brief and straight as the firing of a pistol. The Marsha boys, now under protection of one Duke Kelly, whose stepdaughter better make her way home to River Junction should she wish to see either man alive. But so small as River Junction always seemed to me, from the vantage of the great metropolis, there are yet many places to hide a pair of men from those who seek them. Luella and I, we have already discussed this point, how we must therefore discover some kind of ally from within, somebody who might know where this particular pair of men has been stashed away, which nook or cranny or outbuilding of River Junction conceals these men. My men. My two lovers, past and present, brother and brother, Billy and Anson. If they're still alive. But I'm going to ignore that possibility, cut off its bad head right now before it takes root. Of course Anson's alive. You can't unite with someone so fiercely as that without exchanging some kind of sympathy in the marrow of your bones, whether you welcome this barter or no. Wouldn't I know the stopping of Anson's heart is the stopping of mine? Wouldn't the hurt of his body recall itself in my body? The shock of his pain caused me similar shock. And I feel only queasy now. Queasy with anxiety, that's all. So I stride forth, guided, as I said, by noise and intuition, a half-step ahead of Luella's gamine pace, making for the back of Duke's house. The kitchen entrance, which might yet stand unlocked at this hour, for the convenience of Duke's help. Though the air is still dark, the sky has taken on a promise in transparency, not long before dawn. We tread across the soggy ground, the queer, half-familiar landscape of my youth. Small, broken-down houses replaced by great houses. Trees snatched away to appear somewhere else. Fences repaired. New garages erected to contain new automobiles, all of them as shadows against the wet charcoal world. Closer and closer, the creek roars hard, fighting its banks. And I consider what a good thing it is that Duke's ancestors had the wit to build atop the slope of such a hill. A comfortable hideaway from all that hurtling water. Even here, on the high ground of the ornamental garden, the rain stands in deep pools around the shrubbery, and the grass has turned to swamp. By the time we reach that corner of the house occupied by the kitchen, my shoes are soaked through, my stockings squishing against the leather insoles. I think, damn it all, Billy, could you not have stayed put in Glen Cove? Could you not have just sat and sulked before that comfortable fire in the Inglenook fireplace? The fire that you built by your own hands. I have no proof, of course, that this door exists, linking the kitchen to the outdoors. But it stands to reason, doesn't it? And we've reached some kind of stone beneath our feet, smooth and puddled, suggesting a path or a courtyard. I find the brick wall with my hand and crawl along, Luella in my lee. Already the garden is exposing a little more light and shape. Around the far corner, I distinguish an irregular shadow that might be the tops of the trees shading the fishing hole. My fingertips hurt from the rough brick. The damp tobacco smell of Luella's breath fills my head like a fog. So chill as it is, we might stand but a few degrees from snow. Worse, an ice storm. Had one of those when I was 6 or 7, before I went off to the convent. And I never will forget the sight of the world glazed in ice. The terrible beauty. Walls all coated, locks all stuck, trees and shrubs all dipped in glass. We were lucky. Over McCurdy's way, the limb of a giant elm crashed right through the upstairs, killing Mr. and Mrs. McCurdy in their bed. Left their 3 children orphans. I believe Laura Ann Green took them all in, poor mites, though I don't recollect for how long. Whether she adopted the 3 little McCurdys as her own, or gave them up to some kind of institution. My left hand finds wood. I stop and motion to Luella. run my fingers over the panel until they encounter a knob, dead cold. Won't turn. I jiggle carefully, trying not to make a racket, but the lock is surely bolted. "Move aside," Luella whispers, and I step to the left, blowing on my fingers, which burn from the coldness of the metal. She draws something out of her pocket, an object like a pencil, and inserts it slowly into the keyhole, lovingly, feeling her way as might a midwife confronted with a baby in breech. The lock gives out. The door opens. She steps back to allow me in first. Can't see her face so well, but I expect she's smiling. And yet an uncommon understanding seems to have opened up betwixt the two of us, Ginger and Luella, which requires no words. Like a pair of oxen in yoke, I guess, who might despise each other in pasture. I step past the threshold into the unlit entry, troubling not to see if she follows. Some kind of pantry, seems like, except lined with the tools of housekeeping. Brooms and mops of all kinds, hanging on rows of hooks. I can just make out their shapes. A few more steps, and we pass into a pantry proper, cabinets bumping along my fingertips. And then the room opens up to the kitchen as I remember it, except empty of bustle. Empty of cook and kitchen maid and, God knows, massive garland range squatting mute along the wall. Icebox and sink over there. Work table in the middle. I throw out my hands to find my way to the remembered door at one end of the opposite wall. A swinging door, as I recollect, so as to render the carrying of trays and dishes more efficient. I can't hear Luella's footsteps behind me on the sleek linoleum floor, but I know she's there. Her scent, the warmth of her breath. There is a perilous passage from the end of the work table to the wall with the door. I can't quite picture how it lies. The room's too dark to really see. You can only sense the presence of furniture and cabinet and wall by something closer to instinct than sight. Except when you can't. My foot finds the leg of a chair. I lurch forward, snatching for balance. Chair legs scrape against the floor. Jen falls to one knee, bites back a cry of pain and surprise. Then silence. Only the knock of our two hearts, the delicate whoosh of air from alveoli into throat, into warm kitchen atmosphere, and back again. We remain still for many seconds, counting breaths, listening hard for any stirring. Luella's hand grasps my elbow and urges me up. Disapproval flows from her flesh into mine. I shake her off and strike forward around the chair, this time reaching the wall and then the door, passing through without a squeak into the short hallway to the dining room. The light's a shade better here on account of the great windows. I skirt the massive table, the ducal chairs, the fireboard of dark, mottled marble, and come out the door on the other side. Here be the grand hall, the staircase curving upward in its double tracks, exposed to maybe 25 feet of empty vertical space. You might suggest I should have tried the back stairs, but that particular hall leads past Duke Kelly's private study, which I aim to avoid. Because my stepdaddy is an early riser and always has been, even before he had any fixed occupation to rise to. The white marble gathers up the dawn. I have no trouble at all stealing soundless up those stairs. Luella padding in my wake all the way to the landing above. Blood runs loose, such that I ought to feel dizzy but do not. The queasiness has likewise disappeared. There is only purpose, sharp and singular, filling my head and chest, galloping along my limbs. This landing. That hallway. One door, two doors, three dark mahogany doors beneath my hand. Stop. Seems my heart is pounding hard. Breath rushes low. Run my fingers over the third door, looking for I don't know what. A sign of some kind. A detail recalled to assure me my surmise is correct. something to counter this small surge of doubt that assails me inconveniently as I touch the brass knob, caress it without turning, eyes closed, ears open.
"Are you sure this is it?"
whispers Luella, so low as to make me strain.
"Course I am,"
I whisper back. "Unless he's gone."
"Then what are you waiting for?"
"Nothing." I turn the knob all quiet, and the door swings wide, and I call out in a hushed voice,
"Johnny?"
A figure rises up from the dark bed.
"Geneva Rose, that you?"
But it's not my brother Johnny's voice, oh no. Similar, maybe, but Johnny ain't lived enough years on this earth to collect that much mountain gravel in his throat, disturbing all the honey. I turn and push Luella back from the doorway.
"Go!" I shout. "Run!"
And she does run, sprinting back down the hall like a spooked horse. But it's too late for me. Dumb out of luck this new spring morning, or else the Lord seen fit to abandon me altogether for the greatness of my sins. 7. Now, I did make earlier mention of the spring house, did I not? I feel certain that I did. Small room built of stone atop the running creek, just above the place where it widens out to form the fishing hole, in the absence of an actual spring bubbling up from Duke Kelly's land. It's been there so long as ever I can recollect, from the time of Duke's granddaddy or even before, judging from the general degradation of stone and shingle roof. Used to store meat and milk and butter and such precious things, for we had no ice delivery in River Junction when I was small. Nobody rich enough to pay for ice. Certainly no modern electric refrigeration machine, which we still modestly call an icebox, like there now stands in Duke's fancy new kitchen. In summer, we small fry might head down the slope of the hill to fetch a bit of butter for Duke's bread, or a couple of eggs, or a plucked chicken for frying. Sometimes I might seek out the spring house on my own, for no other reason than to obtain an hour or two of quiet, cool peace during a hot summer's afternoon, for all that there was no window and no light to read by, just privacy. And sometimes we did play in that spring house during our childhood adventures. We might make like it was the Alamo, to be defended to the last man, or else seek shelter there during some game of hide-and-go-seek. Some sudden break of thunder. So I happen to know every last stone of that spring house, maybe 15 foot by 12 foot, wooden shelves to one side, channel cut into the floor along another side. No windows and no light to speak of, though I confess I'm surprised to see it still exists. Surprised to see this humble crib intact. Built into the bank astride the narrow, raging creek this March morning, near enough engulfed by the torrent, even more surprised that Duke Kelly should lead me here of all places, when he has now an entire mansion at his command, an entire town. Dawn has come, but the sun hasn't risen so far as to breach the ridge to the east. We are yet in shadow, the same as we were that last morning in River Junction 4.5 years ago, when I did give my stepdaddy the white scar that streaks downward from his temple, and he bestowed on me a scar of another kind. Whether Duke recalls this particular geographic detail, I can't say. We neither of us utter a word as we sidestep down the last of the slope, slipping a little on the wet grass. He's wearing a pair of handsome, shiny black shoes, and a thick felt hat and a sturdy Macintosh belted at the waist, like any businessman on his way to work. On his mouth there is a pleasant smile. "You bastard," I say, as our destination becomes clear. "You've got them freezing in the spring house, haven't you? Why, they might could drown if the creek runs any higher."
"Then I reckon it be good work you showed up in time, Geneva Rose," he says calmly, reaching inside his pocket.
And now I do notice a recent alteration to the spring house's construction. A door at the entrance, bearing a small window barred with iron, and a thick, heavy lock.
"Lord Almighty," I whisper, feeling a little sick.
Duke withdraws a small object from his pocket, a key, which he inserts into the lock on the springhouse door. Scarce does he turn the bolt and draw back the door, but I push him aside, into the raw darkness, creak roaring against the stone outside, and call out Anson's name. "Ginger?" someone says in a thready, exhausted voice, belonging not to Anson, but another. "Billy!" I exclaim. And while this short exchange is taking place, Duke lifts a lantern from its hook near the door and lights it, and the flame slowly takes and spreads a circle of illumination along the dim stone walls and shelves, the floor now sloshing with a good foot of icy water. The three men held by their wrists to one wall, from chains fixed to the stone at such a height that they cannot stand upright, can only kneel on that hard stone floor, taken over by the rising creek that rushes in through the open channel. Anson, Billy, and Johnny. I scream and plunge forward, down the three steps from the door and into the pool, splashing my way toward them. The wall's not long, and the three men are packed shoulder to shoulder like sardines in a tin. Johnny nearest, head canted toward his massive chest at a strange angle. I grasp his cheek and try to turn up his face to mine, but his eyes remain closed, his skin cold, his neck too stiff to budge. And that's when I see the thick purple bruises at his throat, the black eye, the smashed and blood-crusted jaw, the cold, lifeless skin. "Ginger," Anson says softly next to me. I start up a keenan, cradling Johnny's broken head, his wide, strong shoulders, which could once bear any weight. "You killed him! You killed him!" I wail, smoothing back his poor hair, kissing his poor white forehead. "Not myself. I did not," Duke says calmly. I turn to face him, still holding Johnny's head. "You ordered it done, which is the same thing. Your own son. You had your own son killed, and you call yourself a Christian."
"God himself did sacrifice his only begotten son to cleanse the sins of man."
I don't even recognize the noise in my throat as my own. I just let go of Johnny and launch myself at Duke, pounding and scratching and biting, while Anson shouts at me to stop in a voice like the breaking of glass. But Duke only laughs at my onslaught, laughs and jerks back my right arm behind my back, grasps the hair at the nape of my neck and twists it around his fist so that my scalp about bursts into flame.
"You play nice, Geneva Rose," he says. "You play nice or I pick one of these fine young fellas to go next. You want that baby girl? You want to watch these poor boys die on account of your wickedness?"
I whisper, so soft you can't even hear me above the noise of the creek outside. His face is so close, his chin nearly touches mine. The same sleek, handsome face as before. Skin of smooth olive, eyelids low and lazy, lips red and full. His black lashes cast a furry shadow against the sockets of his eyes.
"Now, you be soft and attend to me. Attend to your stepdaddy that reared you and loved you like you was his own, even though you be but a bastard, begotten in sin betwixt a harlot's legs."
"She was your wife." He tightens his fist in my hair, setting my eyes to sting.
"She were a harlot, Geneva Rose, though I did take her to wife and redeem her, until the Lord saw fit to summon her to his side. As I did take you to my own bosom, but instead of cleaving to me as you should, you turned on me like a snake. Ain't that right?"
He put his mouth to my ear and yanks back my head. "You turned on me, and you turned my own son against me. And by your wiles, you did lure that poor fellow Green.
You done broke my heart, near enough. And so I got no choice, Geneva Rose, no choice but to take an eye for an eye, as the Lord commands. Break your heart, as you broke mine.
You are the devil's own, Duke Kelly." There is no movement from him, no word at all, just that hot breath in my ear. Behind me, someone mutters something, kind of agonized, and Duke lifts his head.
"What you say, son? Was you fixin' to join Miss Geneva in blasphemy?"
Billy's voice, young and defiant.
"I said, take your hands off her."
"Be quiet, damn it," Anson snaps.
"That's right, boy," says Duke. "You attend to your big brother. He knows better than you. He knows there'd be a dozen good men among them trees outside, like an army of righteous salvation, just a-waiting for my word."
I draw breath sharply.
"That's right now. They be waiting with blades sharp and eyes full of glory. Hearts full of vengeance against this Delilah, who has abased herself in the eyes of the Lord Almighty. Who has betrayed her own people that did nothing but welcome her and her harlot mother to their bosom. So you just keep that tongue of yours inside your pretty head, boy. You keep your eyes open and your mouth closed. You attend to what I say. You just watch how I wield the hand of God against them harlots that turn against their people. Turn against the good men and women that reared them up from the cradle." And he releases my hair and spins me around and tears the Coast Guard overcoat from my shoulders and arms. And he throws that coat to the stone floor, now covered by a foot of cold water. I close my eyes because I cannot watch the faces of the two men before me as I stand there in Duke's arms, realizing what I realize, understanding what he is fixing to do, the nature of his vengeance upon me for my crimes against him. The air is stone cold on my skin, on my arms and my chest through the thin, delicate material of my crepe de chine blouse, which I have now worn for 3 days running. Duke's hand curls around my throat, caressing the long tendons. "She always were pretty," he croons. "Not so pretty as her mama, maybe, but pretty enough. Don't you two gentlemen agree? You surely do, I swan, by word and by deed."
Billy cries out, not a word of any kind, just agony.
"Don't look," I say. "Now, you fellows know better than that. I told you both to keep your eyes open, I believe, and I surely don't want to have to hurt all this pretty white skin any more I need. You watch, or I will make her bleed, you hear?"
There is a little pause, and then, "That's right. That's good. Now watch." His fingers find the collar of my blouse and rip downward. As I said, I wear my cami knickers under my clothes, for my brassiere still lies in the drawer of the pool house bedroom in Southampton, New York. And that camisole is made of nothing but silk and peaches, and the air be as cold as stone. And I might just as well stand bare naked just now for all the modesty this scrap of gossamer confers upon me. My face is hot with shame and hatred and grief and something else, panic or what have you. Because we are all at Duke's mercy, all of us. And when he has had his way with me, torturing Anson and Billy by the side of my degradation, he will kill all three of us, one by one, by the might of his bare hands. So I have nothing to lose, have I? Only a few minutes of life lost, and those minutes not worth the trouble of enduring them. Not for me, nor those men who hang in chains before me, who hang for the sake of me. So I come to some decision. I move fast as a pistol shot, dig my elbow into Duke's middle, spin about, and drive my knee into his groin. He grunts and totters back, nearly falling into the edge of that channel through which the creek runs, refrigerating the stone interior of the spring house. I press forward, raising my fist, while someone roars behind me. And Duke's head snaps up just as I fix to swing that fist toward him into his thick jaw. And though my fist strikes home in a satisfying thwack, sending a shock up the bones of my hand and wrist, radius and ulna and humerus all the way into my shoulder, I perceive I have caused no such shock among the bones of Duke's skull. He shakes his head once, as if to discard the sensation of my touch, and reaches out to snatch my arm as it draws back to punch again. He bends that arm backward, near enough, snapping the elbow, smiling quietly as he goes, until the joint folds behind my back and my brain goes white with pain. My body limp and pliant in Duke's hands. We are caught in a terrible embrace, face to face, while he holds my arm bent behind my back and his head looms over mine, smelling of stale tobacco and hair cream and lust. The noise of the creek does rush in my ears, yet louder than before, and above that din I hear somebody groan like it's dragged out the devil's own throat. Anson. And I wonder, sort of inconsequential, because your mind is apt to strange frivolities when you can't reason for pain, if that's the last sound I shall hear on this earth. Anson's voice sending me into eternal rest. But seems the good Lord is not even so merciful as that. Duke's voice intrudes on this meditation, calm and conversational, saying something about how he always did admire my spirit, though it were such temptation to the devil that old Beelzebub done bought it for his own. "Go to hell," I reply, to which command he only sighs, curls his fingers around the fringe of tiny lace of the decolletage of my camisole, and pulls downward, so that my breasts spill free into the open air. For an instant, even the raging creek seems to hold its breath. Or maybe I simply cannot hear it anymore. Maybe my senses are all wound up into such a knot that nothing can slip through. Not sound, nor sight, nor touch. There's Duke's hand on my bosom, sure, but I can't say how I know it's there. Only that my flesh curdles, and some flurry of activity takes place along the wall. "Take your paws off of me," I whisper. Try to lift my hand, but my arm don't obey me, like a wing dragging behind an injured bird. "Would you look at that?" Duke says slowly. The world commences to tilt around me, and then I perceive that I'm the one tilting, that Duke is catching me and holding me upright, digging his hands at the waistband of my skirt so that it falls away, hands on my knickers, tearing those too. And my vision has grown blurred. My head is too light to remain fixed on my neck, and I am floating away somehow, away from his hands. Except I'm not, of course. I'm stuck here on earth, some kind of present hell from which I cannot seem to wake. "Now, this be interesting," comes Duke's voice, from somewhere nearby. "Mighty interesting. What shall we name this particular work of art, gentlemen? Redhead sunk in shame? I guess the gentlemen are having trouble arriving at a decision on the spectacle of my bare-naked bosom and the cold springhouse air, while the creek fixes to flood, the water so cold as it creeps up my legs that I can hardly breathe for the pain of it. The pain in my arm where my stepdaddy near to broke it. Duke holds me in place and turns me to face the wall. The horrified expressions of Anson and his baby brother Billy, and he presents me to them like you would present a prize sow at the county fair. "Oh, them pictures as she took, bearing her harlot skin before the eyes of man. Surely we can summon up a name for this un, betwixt the three of us. Redhead afore her true redemption." He brings his arms around my front and gathers up my two breasts in his hands. "Redhead submits to the embrace of her lord?" Billy cries out. "You're a damned monster!" "Quiet," Anson says. And I cannot look upon them. The faces of these two brothers, who have each in their turn, lain with me in the heat of bed. Ah, Ginger Kelly, on whose bare-naked photographic image 100,000 lustful men have feasted, cannot meet either gaze. Not that of the dear boy whom I once adored, nor of the man for whose sake I would barter this poor body in an instant. Did I imagine Duke Kelly would keep that bargain? I look upon my own brother instead. My beloved Johnny, whose eyes lie ever more closed, and I think he has won. Duke has won. He has sunk me in shame at last. He has surely made a harlot of me.
Of course, says Duke. I might could think of a better name, one that does surely fit my darling baby girl in her interesting new situation.
I go on staring at Johnny, and a prayer starts up in my head for his soul. Dear Almighty Lord, though you did abandon me here in my hour of need, I beg you, find mercy in your everlasting heart for your servant Johnny, who did but sin for the love of me. Duke continues,
What? Speechless, the both of you? Ain't you understood my meaning? Ain't you got eyes in your head? Look upon this fair skin. Look upon this fair bosom of hers and speak me the truth.
His right hand moves to the flat of my belly, all rough and pink with cold, while his left hand does pluck the nipple of my breast.
Which one of you two sinners has got this harlot with child?
8. Now there is silence again, but a different kind of silence altogether. I don't guess I can explain its particular quality, really, except to observe that while the sudden baring of my breast might have occasioned shock, we were none of us in any doubt that said bosom did exist, and if you could wet your finger and test the air for wonder, you might feel it now, rushing and swirling among us like the water that rises up against the thick stone wall of the spring house, spilling inside through the cooling channel. I rasp out, You're a liar, Duke Kelly, and always have been. I'm no more with child than you are.
Now, why should I lie about a thing like that, with the evidence a-laying right here under my hand? I do surely know the look of a woman's bosom when she be commencing to breed.
And I say you're a liar.
I don't guess you've been feeling poorly of late, baby girl. Maybe missed your monthly sickness? Course not.
My teeth now start to rattling, my whole naked body to shaking in the damp cold as fills that stone room.
Now, you just look those two fellows in the eye, Geneva Rose, and say that thing again.
Don't eat. It's impossible, that's all.
Well, now, might be I done put this question to the wrong sinner. I guess any fellow could reckon whether he be the father of a harlot's babe or no. Ain't that right, boys?
Silence, save for the hullabaloo of the creek outside, clamoring to fill the channel, to drown us as we stand. Water's near up to my knees now, and I'm shivering and rattling under Duke's fingers, going a little mad. Altogether too weak even to raise my hand against him.
Come now, Duke says, confess your sins to save your souls. Tell me which one of you has had to do with this whore. Left behind your wicked seed to take root between her legs? Or is it the both of you?
You're a villain, Kelly, Anson says.
You best fess up. You best fess up before I take a fist to her sinful womb, before I commence to cleanse her of wickedness and prepare her for holy redemption.
You're wasting our time, Kelly. Wasting your own time. The water's rising. Miss Kelly is freezing to death. Leave the damn woman alone and do what you came for.
Came for? Duke sort of roars. You think I've been to all this trouble for you, son? Why, you was just doing your job. I ain't got no particular quarrel with that. Done earned yourself a good soldier's death, Mr. Marshall. And I do sworn you shall have it. But this one, this dirty whore of mine, this Judas that betrayed her daddy and her people, I called all you all here on her account, see? To punish her as the Lord does instruct us to punish those who turn against their own.
Only a coward toys with a woman.
You calling me a coward?
I'm saying you and I have a reckoning, and it seems to me you're putting it off. You're tormenting a defenseless female instead of having the courage to match yourself against men.
Duke takes my hair again and yanks back my head, exposing my throat.
Then I reckon you fine gentlemen ought to put her out of her present misery and answer my question. Be a simple one, after all. which one of you boys did sire a babe inside this harlot's womb?
And Billy blurts out, Stop it! Let her go!
Is you confessing at last, Mr. Marshall? You did plant the seed?
Yes! It's mine! She's mine!
Shut